Greetings and welcome back to our ongoing series of the study of the book of Esther, Megillat Esther. We are now in the third chapter, in the second half of the third chapter. And as I mentioned earlier, the third chapter of Esther is evenly divided. The first seven verses dealing with, as we heard in the last two podcasts, Haman, the rise of Haman, his interaction, as it were, with Mordechai. Mordechai's refusal to bow to Haman. I suggested a reason why, and the Haman's anger that then extends to all of Mordechai's people, and the lottery. We now come to the second half, in which Haman now interacts with the king and utilizes the power that's been granted to him, as we saw in the first half, to his own evil designs in the second half. There is much to say about these psukim, about these verses, and we will take our time studying this section. This is the first time that we hear Haman speak. And, of course, we have to remember, as I've said several times, every dialogue that we read in the Megillah is a translation, which means that the words are selected very carefully by the translator, by the author, guided according to tradition, Beruach HaKodesh, by divine guidance, divine spirit, how you wish to translate it, so that the words may allude, may associate with earlier passages in Tanakh, and also to other passages in the Megillah. From the Achashverosh, Yeshno Am Echad, Mefuzar Umfarad Ben Ha'amim, B'chol Medinot Malchutecha. There is a nation, a singular nation, or a single nation, that is spread out and divided among the nations that are within all of the provinces of your kingdom. Which means, from his presentation, and he does not and never identifies who this people is, this people is a single people, which means they have some sort of an associated identity, and yet they are not in one place, unlike everyone else in the Persian Empire. This, by the way, is true of the Jewish people. They did not return to Yehuda. And they are spread throughout the kingdom, which right away, if you are Achashverosh, and as we have mentioned several times, you are concerned with keeping your power base strong, this people is both insignificant as far as your power goes, and they are also a potential problem as being other in every one of the places that they are, that they exist, at least according to Haman's report. And that feeds into the next half. V'datehem shonot mikolam, again the word dat being custom or protocol. Their customs are different than everyone else's. V'date ha-melech enam osim, they do not follow the king's customs. V'la-melech en shovel ha-nicham. Now this is a very pregnant phrase. He says, and it is not worth it for the king to leave them as is. He does not say what he advocates doing to these people. We'll read about that in the next verse, perhaps. But he also doesn't really indicate what the problem is. He just indicates that this is a people that it's just not worth keeping around. They're too much trouble. They're not worth it. Now, there are fascinating midrashim from early medieval times on this verse, which put into Haman's mouth much more explicit things about the Jews. Of course, in the Midrashic strain, Achashverosh is fully aware that this is the Jews we're talking about. Achashverosh is just as interested as Haman in destroying the Jews. They are conniving together. It is a co-conspiracy. That is the Midrashic direction. However, within the context of the Megillah, that is not the case. Let's see what happens. Haman has never identified this people. Haman has also not said what he advocates doing. He just says it's not worth leaving them as is. An interesting point about the Midrash, and Dr. Joshua Berman has written a great article many, many years ago in Judaism Magazine about the Midrashim that appear on this verse, which all the way from the Targumim through the early Midrashim through the later Midrashim have Haman expanding on this and expounding on the evils of the Jews, which include a claim which to our ears sounds very foreign, which is that the Jews are indolent, they are lazy. As an example, in the Gemara, the Babylonian Midrash on this, And Talmud Bavli, Haman says, Etatei HaMelech Einam Osim, Etateihem Shonot Mikolam, they have different customs than everyone else, means, Kule Shata Nafki B'Shahi Pahi. The whole year, they are saying, Shahi Pahi. What's Shahi Pahi? Shabbat Hayom, Pesach Hayom. Every day is a Jewish holiday. They never work. Etatei HaMelech Einam Osim, in one of the later Midrashim, the explanation of that is, that Achashverosh said back to Haman, well, that's their religion, what do you want them to do? And Haman said back, sure. If they were observing their holidays and our holidays too, fine. But they do not observe our holidays. Now, which holidays does Haman mention? Interesting, Saturnalia and Calendia, which of course are two Roman pagan holidays having nothing to do with the Persians. There was a Persian festival at the time of Saturnalia called Mithras, but that's not mentioned in the Midrash because this Midrash is a creation of the Roman period during which as Berin points out in the article, there were charges leveled at the Jews that the Jews were lazy. This is not a charge that you hear in the last few hundred years. We hear just the opposite charge, that the Jews are too hardworking and they are too interested in accumulating wealth and etc. But in those days, that was a claim against Jews. Interesting enough, the Chachmei Midrash, we'll talk about this at the very end of Esther, when we have one or two podcasts on the Midrashic development of the characters, that is how they are developed later. But in the simple read of it here, simply these people are different, they are spread throughout the kingdom, they have their own customs, and they don't follow the king's customs. Imo HaMelech Tov, if the king approves, Yikatev Le'abdam. Now, for this to work, we have to posit, for what I'm about to say to work, we have to posit that le'abed, which is an equivocal word in Hebrew, it's an ambiguous word, it has several meanings, that there is a parallel word in either Farsi or Aramaic, whatever they're speaking in the court, that is also equally equivocal, given to some of the same meanings, and I'll explain. The word le'abed, which means to make lost, can be effectuated in many ways, and throughout the Tanakh you will find, and this is something that Rav Yonatan Grossman pointed out a number of years ago, you will find that le'abed can mean to exile, it can mean to kill and wipe out, it can mean to enslave, it can mean to acculturate, to lose, meaning to lose the separate identity. In other words, Haman basically says, if the king approves, let's negate them. Let's wipe them out. But not wipe them out, meaning physically, declassify them as a separate culture. Or, let's wipe them out. Unclear what he's saying. Let's have them no more. And then, because this is how a successful lawyer does his craft, he throws out a term that is ambiguous, fully intending one meaning, but in order to get his listener to believe a different meaning, slants things so that the listener will believe that it is the other meaning. And so what does Haman say? Vaseret alafim kikar kesef, 10,000 talents of silver. That is several billion dollars in today's economy, not money that Haman himself had. Aseret alafim kikar kesef eshkol ideo seyam lachal avyal genzei amelech. I will have that money weighed and brought to the king's treasury. In other words, Haman is saying that if we can do what I'm suggesting, if you agree to do what I'm suggesting, a great windfall will come to the king's treasury. So what is it that Haman is suggesting? We don't know. We'll know in a minute. Then the king doesn't know. But among the varied meanings of le'abed, the most reasonable meaning here is to enslave. Because when you enslave a people, you immediately seize their assets and the assets come to the king. If you exile them, they take their wealth with them. If you wipe them out, then as we will see later on, you're going to have to pay the people who are going to wipe them out. And that's where the loot will go. And if you acculturate them, they hold on to their wealth as acculturated Persians, who are now keeping the king's laws and customs. Which means that the most likely meaning that a listener would get from here is that that these people should be enslaved. And we also have to assume that Haman knew the king well enough to know that the king would turn down the offer of money. Why is that? So back at in the middle of chapter 1, we discussed the role of Memuchan. Memuchan, who the rabbis say is Haman, Memuchan understood the king and knew how to manipulate the king. Memucan understood the king's motivations and the king's psychological makeup, so that knowing that, feeling like he is the noble defender of the men, as we said a few podcasts ago, the men of the kingdom fighting for their honor and for domestic tranquility will make him feel good about his decision to dethrone Vashti. In the same way here, Haman has to believe from the get-go that Ahasuerus is going to turn down the offer of money. And why would he do that? Because we know that Ahasuerus, as insecure as he is, wants to make sure that all of his advisors and the people around him feel good about him. And if he can say, hey, you can keep the money, then he's going to win Haman over, he thinks. And Haman evidently already knows that, because there's no way in the world that Haman is going to be able to get that kind of money to the king. So let's see what happens. Vayasar melech tabato mi'al yado. What did the king do? He took the ring off of his finger, which for us is, of course, an ominous sign. The rabbis famously say that there were 48 Nevi'im and 7 Nevi'ot, 48 prophets and 7 prophetesses who prophesied for the Jewish people, and none of them was as successful in returning Am Yisrael to repent to God as the king taking his ring off and handing it to Haman. But from a practical perspective, why did the king take his ring off? Because if a decree is going to be written about a particular people, and this decree has to be sent throughout the kingdom, because remember, all these people live throughout all the provinces of the kingdom. And so therefore, it will have to be sent out to let everybody know that these people on a particular date are going to become slaves of the king, or whatever it is that the king thinks is going to happen. That's what we assume. And therefore, we're going to have to write at least 127 different documents written in different languages and in different scripts, because remember, as we saw at the end of chapter 1, there is no rule of Farsi first. Every language is accommodated, every script is accommodated. And therefore, they're going to have to take care of all of that. And the king doesn't have all day to sit around and seal documents. He's going to let Haman do that. He's got other things to do. From a historic perspective, he's got a kingdom to run. From the Megillah's perspective and the peace of Ahasuerus the Megillah wants us to see, we assume he's going to have a party, he's going to war women, whatever else he wants to do. That's the picture that the Megillah wants us to get of him. Now, Vayasur Melech HaTavatom Yal Yadovait Na Lahaman Ben Hamdata Ha'agagit Sorer HaYehudim. And as I suggested in the previous podcast, in the two podcasts ago when we introduced the third chapter, Ha'agagi, which may be a Persian name, may also be an editorial note. Let me explain briefly, because a critical thing in understanding the Megillah. Megillat Esther, which may be in its core form a product of its time, composed by Esther, composed by Mordechai, pieces of the puzzle, nonetheless was not completed as is until generations later, as we see in chapter 9, where the text tells us that the Jews have been keeping the days of Purim for generations, Midor Lador. Dor Vador. They've been maintaining the days of Purim, which means that the final copy of the Megillah that we have is a copy that goes to generations later. In Perek Tet, Pasuk Chavchet, chapter 9, verse 28, these days are remembered and are celebrated in every generation. And so we see that the text was finalized later on. And it is certainly reasonable, as we saw, those of you who studied with me Sefer Shmuel in the OU podcast and Achyomi, we saw that there are pieces in different books of Tanakh where there are glosses or editorial notes that are put in to have the contemporary reader be able to understand. Example, the first book of Shmuel, chapter 9, verse 9, the fourth chapter of Ruth, verse 7, etc. And so it is very likely that when Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the Great Assembly, who finally published the Megillat Esther and put the final pieces on it, added in the Sabriket Ha'agagi, the Agagite, to associate Haman with his ideological ancestor, if you will, from the perspective of later history. His ideological ancestor, which is Agag, read about him in the first book of Shmuel, chapter 15. And so he's called the enemy of the Jews also. Vayomer HaMelech LaHaman. And what does the king say? HaKesef Natun Lach, you keep the money. VeHa'am LaSot Bo Katov Meinecha. And the nation, you can do what you want, what's right in your eyes. Now, Tov Meinecha is a phrase that keeps coming up throughout. For instance, courtiers said to the king at the beginning of chapter 2, that the girl who finds favor in your eyes. And then what do we read later on in chapter 2? That Esther found favor in his eyes, his being Haggai. And then later, in the king's eyes. And now Aman says to the king, if you find favor in your eyes. The king says, I'm giving you the people to do what's favorable in your eyes. Everybody gets to make their own decisions here. There's a certain, not exactly moral relativism, but there is a certain subjectivity to people's behavior, which is alluded to in the Megillah also. Part of the general undertext or subtext of the Megillah of poking fun at this kingdom, at this court that seems to apparently runs by rule and by protocol, but in reality is all chaotic. So now, the king exits. If you're staging this, which is a very good way to think about the Megillah, think of it as a stage, and then you see who's in what room at one time, who hears what, who's present, etc., who knows what, which is always good in narrative and Tanakh to imagine that way. The king leaves, and now the scribes come in. Vayikaru sofrei ha-melech b'chodesh harishon. It was in the first month, which is Nisan, which, by the way, again, as I mentioned in the last podcast, is bad news for Haman, because Haman's going to have to wait 11 months to get rid of Mordechai. Mishlosha Sayombo was the 13th of Nisan, exactly 11 months to the day before the decree was to be acted upon, to be executed. Vayikatev k'chol eshet tziva Haman el achashtar p'nei ha-melech ve'el ha-pachot. And so they wrote exactly the way that Haman commanded to the military men and to the governors. Asher al medina u'medina v'yasarei am va'am, that are in every province and the leaders of every nation. In other words, the Persian governors in every province and the local leaders of every nation. Medina u'medina kichtava v'am va'am kilshono. Again, every province in its own script and every nation in its own language. But shit, now here's the trick. This entire decree is written in the name of Achashverosh. It is sealed with the seal of Achashverosh. Haman has the ring. Haman's name appears exactly zero times in this document. And Haman has done a wonderful job from his perspective of keeping himself out of the limelight and out of the spotlight. As far as everybody else is concerned, Achashverosh has written a decree. That decree, as we're going to find out in a second, is to wipe out, to obliterate the Jews. So what does he write in Ahasuerus' name? And by the way, parenthetically, that means that Haman is now a traitor, because he has taken the king's ring, and he has signed, he has written, drafted, written, and sealed documents in the king's name to something that the king never agreed to. The king never agreed to genocide, and certainly if he did, he would have found out which nation it was. No king is going to just allow one of his advisors to wipe out some people without finding out who they are, and perhaps making sure that it doesn't happen. The king thought it was something else, which means that Haman here is indeed a traitor. We will find out that that will be indeed his end. And now they sent them out with the runners. What did the documents say? That's our suspense. He had the documents written. He wrote them and signed them in the name of the king. But what did it actually say in the documents? Lahashmid, which is to wipe out. There is no question about what Lahashmid means. It's not an equivoque. Laharog, to kill. No question. And then you got to wonder, why does Haman throw in the word Ulaabed? Why does he throw that in? So evidently, he throws that word in to cover himself, to protect himself, so that if for some reason Achashverosh gets wind of this decree, and I'll explain in a minute what I mean by that, then Haman can say, yeah, I told you, la'abed, there it is, la'abed, whatever the word would be in Farsi. So no, that's what I told you, la'abed. Oh, you thought I meant something else, not my fault. So he puts the word la'abed in, which is a totally superfluous word. Once you say to destroy and to kill, Labed is meaningless, but it's there as a cover. At kol ha-yehudim, min na'ar v'yad zaken, young to old, taf and ashim, little children and women, b'yom echad, and one day, b'shlosha asar, l'chodesh shtem asar, l'chodesh adar. On the 13th day of the 12th month, which is Chodesh Adar, and again, as we saw in the second chapter, that the text here, operating during a transition time, when Am Yisrael is going from the biblical style of months, which is numbering them from Nisan, to the Babylonian pagan names, which are Nisan, etc. In order to affect that transition, here the text throughout the Megillah, except in one place, identifies months by both names. Chodesh Nisan, Chodesh HaRishon. So now, but here it's Bishloshah Asar, L'Chodesh Shnei Masar, Chodesh Adar, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is known as Adar, Ushalalam Lavoz, and all of their spoils will be, all of their loot will be for spoils, meaning anybody who kills a Jew gets to keep his stuff. So you see here that there was not a lot of inherent anti-Jewish feeling in the kingdom that telling people you can kill Jews is going to set them out on wild hordes. The opposite. You see that without the incentive of money, which of course it's tragic that that would be enough, without the incentive of money, Haman could not succeed, which again takes us back and tells us there's no way he could have raised the 10,000 talents because he needed to allow their loot to be a payoff to those who would kill him. And now, what happened with this document? Patshegen haktav. Patshegen is a copy. These are all Persian words. Patshegen haktav lihnaten dat b'chol medina u'medina. So there are copies made of this in every province. Galui l'chol amim. It was public and revealed to everybody. Which tells you that everybody knows about it. It's not a secret. It doesn't say don't open till the 13th of Adar. It's open up now. Just know on the 13th of Adar, there's going to be this one day where the kingdom allows you to kill Jews and keep their money. To get everybody ready for the day. Now, what that means is that outside of the palace, everybody knows about it throughout the kingdom. The odd thing is that inside the palace, nobody seems to know about it. As we'll find out in the next podcast and the next chapter, Esther has no idea what's going on. How could that be? So it's quite clear that at least from the way that the Megillah is presenting things, the palace is an isolated island, disconnected from the outside world, where nobody knows what's going on inside the palace except people who have eyes in there, as we've seen with Mordechai. And nobody in the palace has any idea what's going on outside. Except Haman, of course, who has generated information from the palace that's affecting the outside. But otherwise, Ahasuerus is blind to it, knows nothing about it. And that leads us to the last verse. Haratzim yadsut chufim midvar hamelech. The runners ran out hastily to fulfill the king's word. And the rule was also publicized in Shushan HaBirah. By the way, you notice that the way the word dat is used in the Megillah not only is poking fun at the silliness. The rules are not really rules, and the rules are about a queen, and the rules are about drinking. But notice where it leads to. The first rule in the Megillah is about drinking. And what's the rule? There are no rules. What's the next rule? The rule is that if a queen embarrasses her husband, she's not queen anymore. And that all men rule in their household. What's the next rule? Wipe out a bunch of people. On one day, keep their money. And you see how things descend. These are the rules of the kingdom. Pretty pathetic. And the text ends with the apposition, which is an important setup for chapter 4. V'hamelech v'haman yashvu lishtot. The king and Haman sat down to drink. Now, that passage hits us hard. Because the midrashic take on it is that the king and Haman together colluded on this plan, and they're celebrating the end of the Jewish people, and in the meantime, everybody's suffering outside. And these guys are drinking. But Yashvu Lishtot doesn't really mean that. Yashvu Lishtot, from the perspective of Tanakh, means they sat down to dinner. They sat down to have dinner. And they sat down to have dinner because of the end of the day. In the meantime, what's happening? V'ha'ir Shushan Navocha. Outside in the streets, there's confusion, there's upsetness, there's sadness. Everybody is very perplexed. Everybody is very sad. Which means, again, that the split, the chasm between what's happening in the palace, what's happening outside is wide. We see it, and that, of course, leads to the next bit of tension, which is, we know we've already got our girl in the palace. We've already got Esther there. We know that we're going to have to use contemporary parlance, wake up the sleeper and activate the sleeper, as it were. However, how are we going to do that when she's on the inside where they know nothing about what's going on the outside? And that will take us to the fourth chapter in the next podcast. Everyone should have a wonderful day.